Good morning, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
Brent, all the better for talking to you, mate. All the better for talking to you.
And likewise, on our Saturday morning, our regular Saturday morning chat, I hope you've got something special planned for the weekend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, we've got dinner with friends, and I'm looking forward to it.
Good. I've got a couple of questions here from people. This one's from Jen. Jen says, I have been on statins for cholesterol for many years and have a family history of heart disease. Towards the end of 2023, I had a calcium score test, and unfortunately, the score was just over 600. I had already commenced a highly recommended healthy lifestyle diet and increased my exercise prior to the test. I've lost around 13 kilos and still need to lose around about another 5. If you were treating me with these issues, what would you recommend, Dr. Ross, for Jen?
See, this is what I call the 80-10-10 rule. But before we even talk about treatment, you've got to also talk about cause. So I want to explain to everyone listening that 70% of heart disease, this sort of heart disease, a muck in the wall of the arteries, which is what the coronary calcium score tells you, is due to what we call insulin resistance. So insulin resistance is the gene that sets you up for diabetes, blood pressure, high triglyceride, low HDL on your cholesterol, fat around the belly, and all the things that come from that. Cardiovascular disease, obesity-related cancers, fatty liver, gout, polycystic ovaries for ladies. It's all due to that one gene, the insulin resistance gene, 70% of heart disease. 20% of heart disease is due to lipoprotein, little a, which doctors have only been measuring for the last few years because we're developing drugs to lower it. I've been measuring it for 30 years and have been treating it with supplements and other things over that time with great effect as well, but I'm looking forward to these new drugs coming through. So what I'd like Jen to do is have a full blood profile, looking at things like her lipid profile, cholesterol, triglycerides, HDLs, a fasting hemoglobin A1C to see if she has insulin resistance, and also a lipoprotein little a. And that covers the two major genes that causes heart disease. If she wants to take it even further, she can send an email to my office so I can tell her some other things that she can have done as well as far as that goes. But in terms of management, whether it's your management, Brent, my management, or Jen's management, or anyone else listening, it's always what I call the 80-10-10 rule. So 80% of all of our management's got nothing to do with damn doctors. We're not that powerful. It's how you look after yourself. The five keys of being healthy: no addictions, good quality sleep, good quality eating and less of it, 3 to 5 hours every week of exercise, and most importantly, happiness. That covers 80% of management. Now, although I said disease is due to genes, your genes loads the gun, your environment pulls the trigger. So if you have a bad lifestyle on top of lousy genes, you're going to make everything else going on in your arteries so much worse. Now, Jen's lost 13 kilos over a period of time, so therefore she was probably carrying more weight and making her genetic disease worse when she was carrying the weight. It's terrific that she's losing weight, and I would endorse that and continue to endorse that. Of the 20% left, half of that is pharmaceutical drugs, and she does require a statin because her calcium score is well above 100. So I would be running her cholesterol below 4, her triglycerides below 1, her HDL, the so-called good cholesterol, above 1.5, and her LDL cholesterol, the so-called bad cholesterol, below 1.8. And she does that with a combination of statins, lifestyle changes. So there are other things that may be used if she can't get to those targeted levels. But also, all of the, and this is the other 10%, is all the supplements I'm talking about. But just before I get to that, we also need to run her blood pressure sitting around 120 over 80. If her sugar's going up, we need to keep her sugar under good control. And I'd probably put her on a bit of low-dose aspirin because of the very high chlorine calcium score. Aspirin should not be used as a prevention for people who don't have a high calcium score. But if you've got a high calcium score, a stent, heart attack, bypass, at these sort of levels, you should be on a bit of aspirin. And then finally, the supplements. So I've got a cardiac protocol I use for all my patients. I give them the Bergamot products. I can't say the name of the product because TGA won't let me. But it's a BJE100. If you put that into Google, you'll find out what that is. One of those twice a day. I use Kyolic Garlic, 2 in the morning. Ubiquinol, 150 milligrams a day. magnesium orotate twice a day, and finally vitamin K2, 180 micrograms a day, takes the calcium out of the arteries, puts it back in your bones. Now, I've got two groups of patients in my practice, Brent. Those people who follow my advice and those people who don't. The people who follow my advice just become long-term mates of mine. Nothing ever happens to them. The people who don't follow my advice whittle away bits of their heart to their premature death. And that's the issue with all of this. And so that's a very comprehensive overview of how I would manage Jen or anyone else who has this sort of issue.
I had someone listening to us last week, a friend of mine, and you were talking about type 2 diabetes, and he asked me to ask you this question. His name is John. John said, if you have type 2 diabetes with diet, exercise, losing weight, all those sort of things, can you reverse that so that you no longer have type 2 diabetes?
Absolutely. It doesn't always work for everyone, but if you have type 2 diabetes, you're carrying weight, you lose your waist circumference, you get rid of the abdominal fat, which you do from lifestyle. The bergamot products I mentioned also help type 2 diabetes. There's a drug called metformin, which is the workhorse drug for type 2 diabetes. All of these things can take you into the pre-diabetic state, and even in some cases, I've got some patients, I've got them into the non-diabetic state. You never lose the gene for insulin resistance that causes it in the first place, but you can lose the effects of that, which is pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes.
There you go, John. Mark said, I'd love to know what Dr. Ross would recommend for those of us who have had a mini stroke and have a high possibility of being related to the COVID AstraZeneca jab, which has now been withdrawn.
Okay, all right. Let me say, of all of the vaccines for COVID, it is still my opinion that the COVID one, the AstraZeneca one, was the best. But there's a but there. There is a condition called antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which is an antibody against a thing called platelet factor 4. Now, the platelets are the sticky little cells that help the clotting factors form clots and scabs. And if you have an immune reaction against this platelet factor 4, it makes your blood stickier. So what happens when you give an AstraZeneca vaccine to people who have this condition? It does exactly the same thing. It thickens the blood and makes it worse. So I don't believe, from what I've read from all of the literature around this, that the AstraZeneca vaccine just spontaneously caused clotting. What it did is bring out the clotting in people who had this underlying condition. And have a guess what? 5 per 100,000 people have this antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. And have a guess what the incidence of vaccine-related, AstraZeneca vaccine-related clotting was? 5 per 100,000 people. So there you go. So what I'm saying is I do not believe it was from just the AstraZeneca vaccine. You had to have the underlying problem. So it'd be highly likely that Mark has a problem with his platelet factor 4. He should have anti-cardiolipin antibodies and almost certainly go on to blood thinning agents that are going to stop that being an issue for him. And they're the people that should have been concerned. And mind you, Brent, it was pretty easy to pick up people who have this problem, because when you look at a full blood count, the platelets are slightly low. And you just see it on a simple full blood count. And they're the people I give an AstraZeneca vaccine to. And I think when you look at the overall effects of all the vaccines, the RNA vaccines, the Pfizer and Moderna ones, cause more issues than Novavax and especially the AstraZeneca vaccine. But people have to realise the vaccines got us out of the pandemic, but COVID was 10 times worse, especially the initial COVID strains were 10 times worse than the potential side effects of vaccines. But now COVID's devolved down to something that's just a little bit more significant than the common cold. So the vaccines, I believe, cause more reactions now than our current COVID strains. I had COVID 2 weeks ago, and I was sick for 4 days, didn't feel that well, got over it pretty quickly, and back to normal now.
Okay, Dr. Ross wrote a very interesting paper about what we're about to talk about now. How does extreme exercise affect lifespan? Well, high-level exercise, does it extend lifespan?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't think it does, not high-level exercise, but this was a really interesting study. The first one I wanted to speak about, a study out of the British Journal of Sports Medicine, done by really a person I would say is the top sports cardiologist in this country, Dr. Andre LaGuerche, who works down in Melbourne at the Baker Institute. And this is really interesting stuff, because he looked at 200 male elite runners who were born between 1928 up to 1955, who'd all run the sub 4 minute mile. Now, I'll ask you the question, because you're an incredibly well-read and knowledgeable person. Who was the first person to run the sub 4 minute mile?
Roger Bannister.
Absolutely. Now, Dan, the next question about Roger Bannister. Do you know what was also interesting about Roger Bannister?
Well, I don't know what was interesting about him, but I know that once he cracked the 4 minute mile, it wasn't too long before many other people followed and were able to all of a sudden run 1 mile under 4 minutes.
Absolutely. But Sir Roger Bannister was also a very famous neurologist, and he described a thing called the shy dragger syndrome, which is a form of Parkinson's disease. So I just thought I'd throw that one in there as well.
Right.
It's totally irrelevant to this discussion, but it's just interesting. But what they found when they started the study, when Andre started this study, of the 200 elite runners, who, mind you, some of them were born in 1928, 60 out of 140 had already died. But those who were still living, when they compared them to an age match population in their country, because you've got to remember a lot of these elite runners come out of Africa, where the mortality rates aren't that great. There was about a 5-year difference in longevity for those people. So it means that their elite, the fact that they could run a sub 4 minute mile in their 20s did something to protect them against an early death as they age. There's a few reasons for that. One, it could be that there's just something genetically different about people who are elite cyclists or elite runners. They looked at elite cyclists as well. But something about it, if you can do that in your 20s, it gives you some sort of genetic protection as you get older. But also it could be that people who were that level of elite runners in their 20s kept up some form of exercise throughout their life, maybe not high-level exercise, because this study did not look at the effects of long-term excessive exercise over a long period of time, but many other studies have, Brent. And in fact, what it shows is that if you do the Walker suggested dose of exercise, which is 3 to 5 hours per week of moderate exercise, so it should be 2/3 cardio, 1/3 resistance training, where you get up to what we call perceived exertion, which is the feeling of being a little bit hot and a bit short of breath, but not gasping for air, for about 3 to 5 hours a week. That's the sweet spot with exercise. Because when they looked at many of these different studies, when they looked at people who did more than about 7 hours a week, then there was a marked increase in coronary calcification in those people, because I think they were just pushing themselves too hard. And I think really sensible doctors, sensible health professionals have been saying for years that it's all about moderation. And I think people who go to extremes in any way cause themselves some issues. So interesting study, interesting discussion, but I don't think it's suggesting that we all should be high-level exercisers.
Could I ask you, what weight-bearing exercises do you do?
Yeah, I've got weights. So every morning I lift about 10 kilo weights. So you don't want to go overboard, because when you get into our age group, you can just overstretch your muscles and do a whole lot of things and get more injuries. So I do weights every morning. So I've got a routine of weights and stretching that I do every day for about 20 minutes in the morning. And I do half an hour on my exercise bike every day. So I cycle 16 Ks at the highest resistance in a half an hour.
So if people are going for a walk, for example, what I do at the moment now is I go for a walk and I have an hour where I walk and I try to do some push-ups in there as well, some load-bearing push-ups and some stretches, yep, and all those sort of things. So from the time I leave home to the time I get back, at the moment as I'm building up again, I try to do maybe 50 or 60 push-ups and do my walk and do some stretches.
Yeah, and I think that's fantastic. And I think it's also good to have some moderate weights. I don't think people should go overboard. And the worst thing anyone can do is push through pain, push through injuries, because it's over the age of 50, the only joint you blow is your hip or your knee. So you've got to be a bit careful.
You do. Let's talk about a new study that shows that vitamin C can boost DNA damage and cell death in melanoma cells. In other words, vitamin C seems to be good for treating melanoma, Ross.
Yeah. Well, this is what this study that's just come out of recently out of South Florida. And this is the point that I think people have to start embracing what I call integrative medicine. So integrative medicine is taking the best bits of orthodox medicine. There's nothing wrong with orthodox medicine, saved many, many lives, but also the best bits of complementary medicine and putting them together. It shouldn't be a fight, which it often is. And this study was wonderful. It's only been done so far in melanoma cells. It hasn't been trialled in humans as yet. But they treated melanoma cells with an existing chemotherapy agent, and when they added vitamin C to the treatment, it markedly improved the damage that was going on in melanoma cells, the DNA damage, and they had much fewer antioxidant defences within the cells and did nothing to hurt the normal cells. And vitamin C infusions, high-dose vitamin C, are now being used in a whole lot of conditions. And we were speaking before about Jen's cardiac disease and this lipoprotein delay. I just want to tell you a quick anecdote. I've got a patient who I've been looking after for 30 years. His father had bypass in his 60s. His grandfather died in his 60s of heart disease. And this fellow has a high lipoprotein delay. I've had him on a gram of vitamin C twice a day, vitamin E in the form of tocotrienols in the evening, and lysine, which is used for cold sores, but also blocks lipoprotein delay getting into arteries. I've had him on this for 30 years. And most people aren't compliant to things, but this guy, like me, is an anally retentive neurotic. So he's taken this stuff for 30 years, and he's been on the bergamot products for the last 15 years. I got a coronary calcium score on him the other day at the age of 70, and it came back as a big fat zero. Now, that's an anecdote. It's not a clinical trial, but still a very interesting story where things like vitamin C have a very good effect.
Okay, GLP-1 receptors. Now, I've got here that there are benefits and concerns for the GLP-1-R agonists. Tell us more about this in layman's terms, as you do so well.
Yeah, GLP-1 receptor agonists are really Ozempic and all of its mates.
Okay.
So Ozempic's the big blockbuster drug that's just taken the medical world by storm in the last 5 years. And the reason it has is because the evidence is now showing that even if you're not a diabetic, that these drugs can certainly facilitate weight loss. So you've had all the type 2 diabetics come out and say, hey, how come just fat people who aren't diabetics have any right to use this? We're not being able to use it because there has been a world shortage. Because of the trial of the New England Journal of Medicine of around 2,000 people showed that people who used it for about 12 months had about a 15-kilo weight loss. But going with that now, the trials are showing a 20% reduction in heart disease, 20% reduction in heart failure, 20% reduction now in cancer in two big studies. One of 34,000 obese patients, those who used Ozempic, had about a 20% reduction in cancer over 12 months. And then they did a study of just under 1,500 women with breast cancer and type 2 diabetes, half of which had Ozempic. And they found after 5 years later, there was 33% reduction in death and a 41% reduction in heart attack and stroke in the women given Ozempic. You think, well, isn't this wonderful? Shouldn't it be put in the drinking water? And shouldn't we all have it? But here's the problem. A study's just come out in a journal called Cell Metabolism, where they just looked at mice who were genetically primed to develop cancer and were not overweight, who were given the GLP-1 receptor agonists, so things like Ozempic, and they found that these mice had a really bad effect on their immune system, where it actually increased their risk of getting cancers when they were given this stuff. So what it's saying is that when you've treatment in mice, you see, a mouse lives about 2 years. A human lives on average 18 years. So if you extrapolate the mouse time in terms of mouse weeks and human years, you only have to do trials for a few weeks to get some effect on the mice that may occur in humans. And a lot of people don't realise this, Brent, but it takes one cancer cell 9 years in a human to become 2 centimetres worth of tumour. So all I'm saying is that these drugs like the GLP-1 receptor agonist, they work beautifully over 12 months. We have no idea what they're going to do to people in 5 to 10 years' time. And it's just there's a few rumblings that possibly, if you can extrapolate mouse data to human data, there may be an effect of being on these things long term. And the other problem with being on these drugs, just say you're on them for 12 months, you've lost your 15 kilos, you're as happy as Larry, and you say, okay, don't need them anymore, I'll stop. Well, there's a rebound huge weight gain if you do that. So, for example, to use an analogy of cholesterol, if you're on a statin drug and your cholesterol starts at 6, it drops down to 4. If you stop them suddenly, the cholesterol goes up to 8. And it's the same thing with these drugs. You stop them suddenly, a marked rebound weight gain. So I say to anyone who wants to stop one of these drugs, once they've reached their target weight, cut them out slowly. So instead of having a weekly injection of Ozempic, now make it a fortnightly injection for 3 months, then a monthly injection for 3 months to let it wean out of your system very slowly.
How long has Ozempic been available on the market?
Oh, it's been around for about, in Australia, I think, for the last 3 or 4 years.
Right.
But these sort of drugs have been around for probably 10 years. But Ozempic itself has been in 3 or 4 years. And now there's a new one out called Tirzepatide. Its trade name is Mounjaro. And that's even stronger than Ozempic. And there's a new one that's coming out called CagriSema. So CagriSema is the name, and that's even stronger than Tirzepatide. So they're refining these drugs all the time, adding stuff to them. And they have, as I said, a profound effect in the short term. We just don't know yet, do they have long-term effects on the body that may be harmful? We just don't know.
All right, mate. Thank you, as always, for your time and your brilliance. We appreciate it. Thank you for answering our listener questions. And you enjoy the rest of your weekend, whatever you get up to. Enjoy dinner tonight.
Good on you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Talk to you next week. Thanks, Ross. Bye-bye.
Bye.